على جال يوسف زهراء، على جال يوسف زهراء، على جال يوسف زهراء.
درود هجي محمد وعلي محمد. يا صاحب الزمان، أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله الذي لا يبلغ مدحته القائلون، ولا يحصي نعماءه العادون، ولا يؤدي حقه المجتهدون. الذي لا يدركه بعد الحمام، ولا يناله غوص الفتن. ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين، حبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا والشفيء ذنوبنا، سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد.
اللهم
صل على محمد وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين، لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين، صاحب العصر والزمان، خليفة الرحمن، إمام الإنس والجان، ولعن الله وعداهم اجمعين الى يوم الدين. اما بعد، فقد قال الله وقوله الحق. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا ايها الذين امنوا استجيبوا لله وللرسول اذا دعاكم لما يحييكم. صلوا على محمد وعلى محمد. Shahid and Shahid, the martyr and the witness, is our topic tonight, is lecture number 2. Last night we introduced our topic that inshallah for the next 8 nights until Saturday we'll be addressing with all of you. And that is that in any shahadat, any martyrdom, there are 2 components to that shahadat. One is the shaheed and one is the shahid. One is the martyr and one is the witness of that martyr. The martyr has his responsibility, his path. The witness to that shahadat also has its own path. Understanding the philosophy and the ideology of the shaheed will allow the shahid to fulfill his responsibilities. We have to first understand the path by which Hussein ibn Ali gave his life on the day of Ashura, and then equally understand what our responsibility is towards that shahadat. Otherwise, God forbid, it becomes an annual custom, traditional commemoration that we have, and the true maqsad, true purpose of Hussein ibn Ali's sacrifice is not understood. Last night, as an introductory discussion, we talked a little bit about the concept of those in history that were with the Ahlul Bayt, lived beside the Ahlul Bayt, got to a point where they even began to trust the Ahlul Bayt. But when it came time for them to actually show their true nature of their submission, they moved from the path. If I can ask you from now, please, just to move a little bit forward. We are expecting a little bit more people today, so I don't keep bothering you over and over again. Please, sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. If you can keep the door area clear, that'd be great. Thank you very much. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Because the reality is that these types of discussions bring life to us, inject us with hayat and zindagi. Without it, God forbid, we are those people who Amir al-Mu'mineen describes in Nahj al-Balagha as walking corpses. Their limbs are working, their legs are working, they're inhaling, they're exhaling, but on the inside, they're dead. Then there are those who are not even in this world. but they're very much alive. Remember through their amal. Remember through the impact that they have had on their lives. For example, we look at somebody like Professor Shahid Sibt Jafar, rahmatullah alayh. The essence of the beauty of this man, not as a poet, but as a muballigh deen, was not fully understood until he left this world. Then we understood his khidmat, his service towards the deen. Even now, I'm told that sometimes his grave is the one that has the most flowers on it, the one that has the most ronak in it, the one that has the most people in it. There's always candles lit on his grave. He's gone from this world. But through his amal, his actions, his service, he's very much alive today as well. That's why in Dua Ahad, it's a beautiful, beautiful concept. In Dua Ahad, which is a dua that we should recite every single morning to renew the bay'at that we have towards Imam Zamana. In that is a beautiful piece of this dua. This piece is my favorite. It says, if death befalls upon me before your zuhur, فَأَخْرِجْنِي مِنْ قَبْرِي مُعْتَذِرًا كَفَنِي شَاهِرًا سَيْفِي مُجَرَّدًا قَنَاتِي. Look at this beautiful line. This is a man now who's been buried. He's supposedly to be dead. He's gone. But he's saying that if death befalls upon me before you arrive, take me out of my grave. My libas is my kafan. In one hand is my sword, in one hand is my shield, ready to serve you, Imam. We buried him 6 feet under. He's gone. But when you leave with the love of the Ahlul Bayt, you never truly leave this world at all. Your body might be gone, but the love that you have for the Ahlul Bayt is forever there. These types of gatherings, these types of discussions, give us life. Without it, we are walking corpses. Without it, we are the hamster on the wheel, going faster and faster and faster. When we stop, we are exactly where we started from. A little bit more tired now. And that's why the amount of ta'keed and emphasis placed on some of the adab of these types of gatherings, specifically the farshi adab of Abdullah, from either our ajdad or even in riwayat and hadith, we have this. For example, Imam Rada alayhi salatu wasalam, he says, "Man jalasa majlisan yuha fihi amruna lam yamut qalbuhu." The one who sits in a gathering where our affairs are discussed, we are talked about, we are remembered, us the Ahlul Bayt, the man who sits in such a gathering, lam yamut qalbuhu, his heart never dies. Yawma tamutul qulub, on the day where the hearts will die of fear, the day of judgment, this man who sat on this farshi adab, his heart will not die. We have riwayats, and sometimes, you know, these youth make fun of us and say, oh, okay, that sounds kind of weird. Before the arrival of the first person in this masjid, where the farish is down and the dhikr of Imam Hussein is about to begin, before we arrive, the farishta are already here. We here have the aqidah. And they spread the wing for us to sit on. And we sit metaphorically on the wing of an angel. And the last person leaves the Nabiya and locks down and closes the door and goes towards home, this angel wraps up his wings and begins his journey back towards heaven. And as he passes by other angels, he gives off this beautiful scent. And the angels ask, what is this smell that you're giving off? They say, it's the dhikr of Abu Abdullah al-Husayn. So naturally, when we have this concept, that's not something that we've made up. These are supported by traditions of inside of our book. The way we sit, how we sit, the adab that we sit, everything is there. I mean, if you knew my father, when it came to this concept, he was very strict. He had a long list of things that I could not wear, could not do, when it came to the majlis of Aba Abdullah. My youth, sometimes you think that your parents are strict. Let me tell you a little bit about my father. He would tell me, number one, no jeans. No jeans. And those of you who wear jeans, I'm not saying you're doing anything wrong, please. Don't go home right now and change your pants. You're okay where you are, inshallah. This is just something my dad had, love for Imam Hussein. No jeans, no t-shirt, no hats, no candy, no gum in my mouth. He would put me beside him and say, don't move. I would say, Dad, I'm going to the bathroom. He goes, go right here if you have to. Do not move from where you are. Back then, of course, there weren't good English speakers like you have today, mashallah. No salawat, no matter how you do it. I live in Toronto. I'm considered your Parosi at least. I have some haq at least. So fight. Back then we had no English speaker. So what would he do? He'd say, look, I go, Dad, I don't know Urdu. I don't understand the language. He says, today you'll get 1%. Tomorrow 5%. Then 10%. Then 20%. If you don't know a word, ask me. I'll translate for you as it goes. Back then, there were no big backpacks. You would enter, you know, inside that backpack, there's a snack, there's an iPad, there's a change of clothes, there's a coloring book, a paint set, Play-Doh, all of that for a 45-minute majlis. Okay? Back then, there wasn't all that. It was me, it was him, that's it. No iPods, no I this, no I that, just I and him, and that's it. Okay? But the strictness came from what? He said there has to be a difference between what you wear and how you sit in any other gathering and what you wear and how you sit in the gathering of Imam Hussein. There has to be a difference. If there's a difference, at least on your head, show that difference. How we sit. He would tell me to not even lift my legs up against my knees. Sit cross-legged. Or sit on your knees, for example. All these things are there. Today, this arts culture is lost, unfortunately. If the child gets through a 45-minute speech without crying, what body bath will be, right? So that's the problem that we have today. These types of gatherings, this fellowship of these gatherings are our lifeline, as I said before. Our hayat is through here. Everything we learn from akhlaq to fiqh to tariqh to ilm is from this member. And the barakat of this belongs to Abu Abdullah al-Husayn. Salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So I ask you, please inject this love of Imam Hussein inside of your children. Teach them how to dress and how to sit in these types of gatherings. Our elders, it drives them crazy sometimes. I know it does. The other point I want to make here before we get to our discussion, a 5-minute discussion, with your permission, inshallah. On the Urdu language, I am born and raised in Toronto. I've never set foot in Pakistan. My parents are from Karachi. However, the one thing that I understood after going to the Hausa, this is a very key point for our kids. I realized in the Hausa that the Urdu language is not a Pakistani cultural Hindustani language that our parents have understood and now brought from them from the East. It's not. It's a language of the deen. It's a mazhabi language. You cannot group it into the into languages of Spanish and Hindi and French and German. No. These three languages, Urdu, Arabic, and Farsi, are the zaban of the ma'rifat of our deen. The amount of work that has been done in these three languages towards Islam, no other language has been done. And us, as people who promote the English language, not even 2% of it has been done in our language. So my point is that if there is a little bit of possibility for you to teach your child Urdu, not for anything else, but because an entire ocean of knowledge will open up once he knows English, then do that. I promote that. To my kids, please, stop thinking that Urdu is some backward, back home, cultural, my parents don't get it language. It's not. English is not the end all and be all. English is not the elite language. In fact, the weakest language we have in the world right now is English. How it became an international language, I have no idea. The most deepest language we have is the language of the Quran, the Arabic language. No doubt about it. Those of you who have studied Arabic, you know, it is the most difficult language to understand and to learn. especially for a non-Arab. We did 5 years of Arabic grammar in the house. 5 years of grammar alone. And we lost sleep for 5 years. We couldn't do it. It was very difficult. So I ask you, to my youth and to my kids, number one, give the Urdu language its importance and ahmiyat. To my parents, don't give up that easily. I have two daughters. They both don't know a word of Urdu. We do our best to teach them Urdu. Doesn't happen. But if we present it as a wasila towards the deen, then it becomes a little bit of a different discussion altogether. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Back to our discussion. Understanding Imam Hussein's mission, part of that is to understand in what era he existed. Understanding, of course, the sulh of his brother, the death of Muawiyah, and then the announcement of the successor of his son Yazid. Let's go back a little bit, and today will be a little bit of a history lesson like I love to do. The second Khalifa, there was an area known as Shamat. Shamat consisted of four countries: Jordan, Palestine, Syria, and I believe Qatar, if I'm not mistaken. Or perhaps Turkey. These four countries, a mass area, a huge area, was known as not Sham, Shamat. And it was strictly a Greek, Roman, Christian area. That's very important to understand. During the time of the second Khalifa. The second Khalifa was obsessed with conquering areas of land. He wanted to spread the empire of the Islamic world through conquering different areas that were not touched during the Prophet's mission. One such area that was in his plans was Shamat. Huge area, lots of resources, untouched resources. He sends, history now very carefully, follow me please. He sends two individuals, Mu'awiyah ibn Abu Sufyan and Yazid ibn Abu Sufyan, Mu'awiyah's brother, to Shamat to conquer Shamat. They go there and they conquer Shamat physically. The second Khalifa then makes Mu'awiyah the governor during his Khilafat of that area of Shamat. This is crucial now. Now, why he did that, how he did it, why he should not have done, that's not my topic. It's a blunder that he made that later on we'll find out what the effect of that blunder was. When Muawiyah got to Shamat, they were mostly Christians. They had heard some rumblings about some individual named Muhammad in Medina that talked about him being the prophet of Allah. But the effect didn't really reach that area. Before the Prophet of Allah could even begin to talk about Shamat and other areas, he left this world. He wrote letters upon letters inviting people towards Islam, but the actual conquering of any areas wasn't a possibility for him. So Muawiyah enters this area of Shamat and begins to introduce Islam to these Christian individuals. Absolutely no access to Islam, never even heard about the religion. Again, heard about some rumors about some Prophet of Allah in Medina, but the teachings, the principles, the usul of the deen were not presented to them at all. They had no idea what Islam was. Their basic connection with Islam was based on the teachings of Muawiyah. Understand this for a moment. We sometimes wonder, how could it be possible that the Ahl-e Haram are entering the Bazaar of Sham and people are throwing rocks at them? People are abusing them verbally. How could it be that somebody doesn't understand that this qafila is made of those individuals who come from the lineage of the Prophet of Allah? It wasn't the Shami's fault. They understood the deen through Muawiyah. How could you possibly understand anything of the deen if your teacher is the son of Abu Sufyan? So the umid and hope that we had in the Shamis to understand the deen was not there. He ruled for them for over almost 20 years. In that process, he mentioned to them that this whole talk about the Ahlul Bayt, that's me and my family. Ali, Fatima, Fulan, these individuals are not the Ahlul Bayt. They pretend to be, but they're not. The true Ahlul Bayt are us. He began to brainwash them. He told them, if you rise up against your Khalifa, you're wajib al-qatl. So whatever I say, it's hujjat for you. If I tell you to recite Salatul Jummah on Wednesday, it's hujjat for you. And they did. No questions asked. Why? Because the Khalifa said so. And he began his entire mission of conquering Sham, and it became his baby. Now when Amir al-Mu'mineen becomes the Khalifa al-Dahiri, 4.5 years, and the first thing he did is he removed all the governors from Osman's Khilafat and replaced them with his own governors. When it came time for Sham, at that moment, of course, Muawiyah wasn't that ready to give up his baby. He worked very hard. He conquered them. He converted them to his ideology. He brainwashed them. And now he has them eating out of the palm of their hands. Whatever I tell them to do, they'll do. The deen that they made is the deen that I presented to them. That's why in his will to Yazid, he says, keep the Shamis close to you. If there is some revolution somewhere else in Hijaz, in Iraq somewhere, send them. Squash that revolution, but bring them right back. Don't let them settle anywhere outside of Sham. Because then they'll start to realize that, wait a second, Muawiyah's Islam is one, Muhammad's Islam is another. And they'll revolt against you. Keep them close. Keep them brainwashed. Keep them in the palm of your hand. If you let them travel, they'll begin to realize what our plan is. Jung Yusufin broke out, as many of you know, and that was one of the most horrific incidences in Islamic history. This arbitration that happened between Muawiyah and Amir al-Mu'mineen, if that had been avoided, if the Khawarij had a little bit of basirat and insight, then perhaps Karbala would not have happened altogether. A turning point. When Muawiyah regained his control of Sham, now he realized that forget the idea of me being the governor of Sham, I'm going to shoot for the Khilafat of the Islamic world. I want you to imagine this for a moment. This is the son of Abu Sufyan, the staunch enemy of Rasulullah, the man who had nothing to do with Islam whatsoever. How he became governor of an Islamic area, I have no idea. How he became the Khalifa of the deen, I have no idea. But as we know, after the Sunnah of our second Imam, he became the Khalifa. And the entire world is watching this. The Shamis, of course, are not at fault. They don't know, they're ignorant. They're not aware. The people of Hijaz, Mecca, Medina, the stronghold of the Bani Hashim, where were they? It's not like they had no idea who Muawiyah was. They knew who Muawiyah was. It's not like they were deprived of the information of whom Muawiyah's father was. Of course not. And yet they sat there and they allowed somebody like Muawiyah to go from the governor of Sham to the Khalifa of Islam. And everybody was quiet. So now when Imam Hussein comes out for his Qiyam and his revolution, there are two groups of people. Please follow me very carefully. We will draw parallels to today's day and age. He comes out, he sees the Shamis on one side, he sees the rest of the Islamic world on the other. The Shamis are uninformed, ignorant. They don't know any better. They were never told who the Ahlul Bayt were. Never told who the Prophet of Allah was. Never told his true teachings. But the people of Hijaz, Mecca and Medina, Basra, Iraq, they knew, of course, who the Prophet of Allah was and who the Ahlul Bayt were. If one group was unaware, one group was asleep. If one group was dormant and static, the other one was ignorant and brainwashed. If one group needed agahi one group needed bedari. Understand this for a moment. If one group needed awareness to be agah, the other one needed awakening to be bedar. One was asleep, one was unaware. Imam Hussein realized that by me going towards Kufa, giving my life in Karbala, I will awaken the masses who are asleep. When his body was eventually martyred, the news spread like wildfire. And those individuals who were asked by Imam Hussein to come and help them, they spread this news that, look, this battle in Karbala, it's between two shahzades. Right? It's between the son of Ma'adi and the son of Ali. They have, you know, they have beef from God knows when. Don't worry about them. Leave them alone. It's a personal matter. It's a gharilu battle over there. Leave it alone. It's not nothing about haq and batil. It definitely is not about justice and injustice. Nothing. Don't get involved. That's their personal issue. But when they realized that this blood was shed the way it was shed, when they realized that the letters were written, the amount that were written, then they realized that this was not about some family issue that went back towards Ali and Muawiyah. This was something that was serious. And yes, an awakening did occur, albeit at a very snail's pace. But the awareness of Sham did not occur by the shedding of Imam Hussein's blood. Please follow me for a second. Because if they were aware, the Shamis, they would not treat the Qafila from Karbala the way that they did. That's our belief. Our proof is that no doubt they heard, they saw the head of the spear, but that didn't have the impact on them. They thought that this was a Qafila that was trying to uproot the Khilafat of Muawiyah. And they've been told since day number one, those who try to do that, they have to be killed. So they would celebrate in the streets of Sham that Muawiyah and Yazid defended the Khilafat and killed these rebels, na'udhu billah, that were there to just to stir up some problems. It wasn't until Bibi Zainab's khutbah in the Darbar of Yazid where the awareness of the Shamis began. What Imam Hussein's blood could not achieve, Bibi Zainab's words did achieve. What bodies could not do, the sermons of Imam Sajjad and Bibi Zainab did. Examine those two, my youth out there. I know reading a book, God forbid, is difficult nowadays. They have YouTube videos now about these sermons. They actually have had this, you know, this acted out scene. They have subtitles. Just click on the video and watch it. And there, you understand that this khutbah complements each other so very well, these two. Imam Sajjad's khutbah was all about introducing who the Ahlul Bayt were. He doesn't anywhere mention Yazid's tyranny or oppression. Nothing. Starts off by saying what? Us, the Ahlul Bayt, are known by six qualities. And lists them out. Ilm and Hilm, Shaja'at and Falan Falan. And talks about the fact that those who know me, they know me. Those who don't know me, I'm the son of Mekkah and Manah. I'm the son of Zamzam and Safa and Falan and Falan. I'm the son of Fatima, the son of this man, the son of that man. He says to them, who am I? I'm this. Bibi Zainab's khutbah wasn't like that. Bibi Zainab's khutbah didn't mention the Ahlul Bayt. She listed and exposed the tyranny of Yazid in the courtyard of that very man. When Imam Hussein created awakening for those who were asleep by his blood, Bibi Zainab created awareness with her words right there in the heart of the courtyard of Yazid. Today, my brothers and my sisters, today, we also have two groups. There are those who are asleep, dormant, those who are completely indifferent, those who are, they know full well, but they don't want to say anything. Then there are those who don't know, they're unaware. They have no idea what's happening. They don't understand, they actually believe that Daesh is actually a sect of Islam. And when from these members they're told that Daesh is a direct affiliation to the Ahl Sunnah world, I don't blame them. When our ulama and maraja are time and time again trying to plead with the nation, saying, please, don't call them from the Ahl Sunnah. They are Takfiri, they are Wahhabi, they are Salafi. They have no connection to the deen whatsoever. These guys are not even human beings. Forget Muslims. Any group that would collect Shia youth under the age of 30 and put them in a pit and open fire on them, record that, send that recording to the mothers of those youth on the day of Eid, are not human beings. But we fall into traps sometimes. Our maraja are saying ittihad, 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 and we're saying, wait a second, they're beheading us in Iraq. They're destroying us in Syria. They're attacking our shrines. And you want me to unite with them? If one group is asleep, the other one is not aware. Our job, and the people who are giving their life right now in the East, their blood is causing an awakening. Those of you who are informed about what's happening in the East, you know that right now there are two parallel paths. And the two parallel paths are very, very clear to us today. One path is that of dhulm and injustice and tyranny. That is continuing, unfortunately, at a rate that this world has never seen before. The other path is the path of sha'ur and awareness and awakening. And people are actually out there on the streets who normally would not be on the streets. Yes, granted, the second path is not fully formed yet. But we know from the ulama who go there, from the groups that are there, they're telling us that the people are slowly starting to awaken themselves. Especially in Pakistan, they tell us that no longer do they accept the dhulm that's happening on them. The problem is that they're outnumbered. They're 10% of the population. So these two parallel paths are happening. What's happening in this part of the world in the West has to be an awareness. That's where you and I come in. That's where you and I come in. I always say this wherever I go, I tell you as well. These doors that lead to Abu Abdullah are not exclusively ours. I ask you if you can, your Sunni friends, your non-Shia friends, your non-Muslim friends, bring them. Let them sit. Let them listen to what we do. Their image of Azadari is on CNN. Their image of Azadari is a man who's drenched in blood. Their image of what we do for Imam Hussein is something else. Tell them. There's academic discussions here. There's emotional outbursts here. There's brotherhood here. There's sisterhood here. There's hot chai here as well. All these things are there. If we don't do that, if our four walls are limited to us, then we are not able to spread the message. Yeah, we have the random jaloos here and there. With all due respect, I saw one jaloos that had a Pakistani flag on it. I love Pakistan and all, but please. The jaloos in this part of the world, part of it is to show our gham and grief. Part of it is to believe in the mission of Abu Abdullah. Now, what is our mission here? Awareness. Why is it so important that we do it? Let's examine that. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. You see, the reality is this. Our youth today, there's a whole discussion right now, unfortunately, amongst the academic circles. The intellectuals, as they call themselves, of Islam versus modernism. It's a whole different topic altogether. That the Sharia of Islam that's 1400 years old is outdated. Doesn't apply to today. Even the concept of fasting in the summertime. I remember last year I was in Toronto, and there our iftar was at 9:30. Our suhoor was at 3 o'clock, 3:30. It's 6 hours of eating time, basically. A man comes to me and says, Mulana, what is this? This is a little bit too much now. You know, I don't think that the Prophet of Allah wanted us to fast 16 hours like this. Can we not average it out to say at least 10 to 11 hours maybe? This is too much. I said, Uncle, you forget the fact that we used to fast in the winter time as well. When our Fajr was at 7 p.m. and our Iftar was at 4:30. Those 9 hours of a fast, we forget very easily. With 16 hours of eating time and 9 hours of, or 8 hours of, fasting time. He says, no, but that is how it should be. This is not how it should be. So this, I mean, it's a joke, and he was joking around, but sometimes the thought pattern is that this is not the way Islam should be, in this day and age especially. We work, and we raise our kids, and then we fast. It's too much. On top of that, the attack that we have on other aspects of the deen, for example, khums. I was telling a youth group, we had a discussion last night, or the night before, whatever it was, I'm losing my days now. A man comes to me and says, I have made khums haram on me. I'm just letting you know, Mulana. I love when they tell me as an FYI, it's really nice that you're keeping me informed. Thank you very much. I just want you to know on my behalf, Mulana, that I have made khums haram on myself. I said, thank you very much. May Allah bless you, inshallah. What do you say? Why? I ask him, it's a money laundering system that the ulama and the maraji are feeding off of. That's it. These are big words. They have to have a hisab and be a judge for such words. The idea is that you have a marja living in, na'udhu billah, may Allah forgive me, living in some cave in the east, has no idea what we go through in the west, and they're sending fatwas from that cave for us to follow here in the west. We have to have a little bit of what's called chishme basirat, a little bit of insight, please, I ask you. Especially communities like these, mashallah, where the ulama come and they talk about being the Ahl al-Basir. Other communities across the US might need a little bit more help. Detroit, Zanabia, mashallah, all of you are fully known, this community, to be one who is aware, who knows their stuff. When I asked another alim who's been here before, look, I'm going to Zanabia, do you have any advice? We talk about you all the time, right behind your back. Yeah. He says, they know their stuff. So don't insult them with Mickey Mouse stuff. I said, inshallah. All I know is Mickey Mouse. I don't want anything else. He says that they know their stuff. It's fine, inshallah. If you know your stuff, and mashallah you do, you know that the enemy will attack three things. Please, very carefully. And I ask you, if you are confused, come and talk to me afterwards. I sit here during matam, I wait afterwards, in case any of you have any questions. If you want to challenge me respectfully, come and talk to me. Three things. One is leadership. Number two is finances. Number three is the motivational factors that we have towards our deen. Leadership is our marajid or rahbariyat. That's being attacked. At all sides being attacked, internally, externally. People will tell me that Allah, Mulana, he's made me aqil. Allah has made me aqil. I have aqil. I'm a free thinker. I don't need to rely on the fatawa of some marja who has not even stepped foot in my country. Because we believe for a second, let me also address this as well. Sallallahu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. We believe that mashallah, mashallah, the insan, the human being, you and I, have gone through immense advancement. Taraqi, pishrat, mashallah, is huge. We are not the human being we were 30 years ago. We have skyrocketed. I mean, mashallah, we are in a different level altogether. I don't know where they're getting this idea from. We don't measure the progress of the human being based on what's outside the human being. Oh. We measure the progress of the human being based on what's inside the human being. If anything has gotten smarter, it's our phones. It's our cars. I can turn off my stove, apparently, from right now, from where I am inside of my house in Toronto. Fantastic. Anywhere in the world, if I'm lost, I can GPS it, it'll tell me exactly where it is. Everything around us has moved forward. We, and this is my challenge to all of you, we haven't progressed, we've regressed. Look, very, very quickly, again, history. The Zamana of Jahiliyyah, when we hear about it, and those individuals who were quote-unquote Jahil, we laugh sometimes. We think, wow, what a weird group that was. How did the Prophet of Allah even exist amongst people like that? They had three distinct habits. Number one, idol worshiping. Number two, disrespecting of women. Number three, common bloodshed for no apparent reason. Idol worshiping, disrespecting of women, and bloodshed. These three are not history. The era of Jahiliyyah before the arrival of a holy prophet, these three were there. They would bury daughters alive. They would see women as liability. They would trade women like they would trade gold or material or weapons. They had a daughter, they would bury that daughter alive. If an animal from one qafila ate the grass of a house of another qafila, that would instigate a war of 100 years. Let's come to today. It can be said that these three exist today. It can be said that idol worshiping exists. The idols have changed, the worshiping has not. We can say that the disrespect of women is still existing today. Yes, this whole feminism movement, which is ridiculous if you ask me, talks about equality. That a woman can do what a man can do, but only better. That if you're the CEO, I'm the CEO. I will cut my hair to look like you. I'll wear a suit to look like you. Absolutely. What they don't realize, something I mentioned in the majlis today in the daytime. Everything has a path. لِكُلُّ شَيْءٍ طَرِيقٍ. And so long as you embrace that path, you are going towards kamal. A man has a path, a woman has a path. A woman's been given certain things that you and I have not been given. Just spend 2 hours with your kids. That's all I ask you. Alone in the house one day. You'll realize how difficult it is. Try to go through the amount that she goes through in terms of physical pain, carrying the family together, dealing with her in-laws, raising the children, dealing with all of this fitna around, gossiping, backbiting, if the house is in shambles, it's a woman's fault, etc., etc., etc. All of that is there. The man has his path. Allah has given things to us that they haven't given to the sisters. It's not about superior and inferior. It's about embracing your path. It also is not about equality. Islam, my youth, understand this. Islam is not based on equality. It's based on? Say it loud. Justice. There's a big difference. Where there is equality in the eyes of Islam, it's the ajr and the reward between a mu'min and a mu'mina. There's no difference there. It's not like Allah will say, okay, because you're a man, you get the double reward, and because you're a woman, you get half the reward. But when it comes to the huquq and the responsibilities and the rights and the path, that path is based on justice. Look, I'm sitting there and my one-year-old daughter is sitting there. It's time for dinner. Okay? I have some baklava that I got from Dearborn, Michigan, mashallah. I give her a piece. She has two small teeth, bichari, on the bottom of her mouth. Okay? I go, eat some. It's from Dearborn. I brought it all the way from Michigan. Have some, please. It's apparently the best that you'll ever have. I'm eating. I look at her, she's not touching it. Equality says what? That you have baklava, I have baklava. But it's also unjust. She is not able to consume what I'm giving her because she doesn't have the capability to do so. It's not that she's inferior to me. It's that she's been given certain dimensions that I have not been given. If we can understand it, if we can understand it, inshallah, then we can actually move towards our Kamal. But this society will tell you, oh, two witnesses for women and one for a man, for any crime. That means that a woman is half the value of a man. MashaAllah. And our sisters buy it. Yeah, you're right. That's not right. Islam is a feminist, is a you know, genderist religion. It's against women altogether. God's a male. He says he himself in the Quran. All the prophets are males. All the imams are males. This entire religion is made for guys, not made for me. Sometimes the way we look at things is a little bit different. Change your glasses. A witness in a crime, understand this. Small example for my sisters. A witness, to be a witness in a crime, is not a blessing. It's a burden. Agreed? Agreed. If you understand that, the beauty of Islam is this. It elevates the woman so high, where it says that we don't want you to take on that burden all by yourself. We want you to share that burden with somebody else. So both of you handle this burden together. It's a little bit easier. But for the male, you take on that burden all by yourself. Now where is God? God's on this side, right? Not on this side anymore. Okay? So this concept that we have about women, I'll give you another story. From Toronto, there is a girl I know who was expecting a child. She went inside of the lab. The story I've told before. Ultrasound technician room. Big sign that says the technician is not able to tell you the gender of the child. We're talking about last year in Toronto and not some gown in Pakistan. After the ultrasound, the sister who tells me herself firsthand, I asked the technician, why are you not able to tell the gender? Because when we had our kids, if we asked, they would tell us. She said there are some families that when they find out they're having a daughter, they abort the child. Where is this? In the Great West. In Toronto. 12 months ago. Or we have this idea of bloodshed in this world. That, of course, is in front of us. We hear about him and the liver of Hamza, and we cringe. And yet, those same videos are available on YouTube. Organs are ripped out and consumed, and then held to the camera like he is proud of what he did. Don't talk to me, with all due respect, about the taraqi and the pishraft and the advancement of the human being. We have regressed back to where the jahiliyyah is. And our hadith tells us that when the human being goes full circle, and ends up exactly where that dhulamat during the time of the Holy Prophet comes, then once again, the nur of Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam. Muhammad. Will come about. So we have a lot of work to do. Our work involves first ourselves. We are waiting for a man who right now is in Ghaibat, who will come and fix all this mess. Absolutely, we understand that. But our duty while he's in Ghaibat is higher for us than anybody else. Why is that? And then towards Messiah, inshallah. There is not a school of thought in any faith out there that doesn't believe in some form of a savior. Do your research. From Buddhists to Hindus, from Christians to Jews, from Muslims to everybody. Everyone is waiting for somebody to come and fix this mess. Of all of these groups out there, we, the followers of the Ahlul Bayt, know more about the man who's coming than anybody else does. Point number one. We know who he is. We know how he is. We know 11 of his generations before him. We know his father, his grandfather, who they were, how they were, what they were. All of this we know. We also know that he's alive. He's amongst us. We're not waiting for him to be born like some others are. We have a hadith that says sometimes it's to the point where you might even look at the imam and not recognize that to be the imam. And the examples that are given are Nabi Yusuf's time when he was a prince of Egypt and his brothers went to him thinking of him to be the prince. They would be in front of Yusuf and they weren't able to recognize that this was my brother. But he was able to recognize that these are my brothers. That's why when he will come, inshallah, the imam will come, we'll look at him, and some of us will say, I have seen this man before. As the amount of ma'rifat grows to that who is coming, our responsibility in this era of intidhar also grows as well. It's up to us to introduce him to the masses, prepare the grounds for his arrival. We know more about him than anybody else does. And that begins here. Make yourself aware. Enter the world of Islamic politics. Don't be afraid of this word. This word, siyasat, lab khilafat, has become badnam, unfortunately, in our communities. We equate siyasat to fitna, facade, corruption, and disunity. No, it's not the case. Islam is a complete, encompassing religion. When the revolution of Iran started out, and people from Tehran would tell Imam Khomeini that, Agha, please, this, leave the world of politics alone and you worry about your deen. Don't allow the deen to become political. Look at his response, Imam Khomeini. He says, I'm not here to make the deen political. I'm here to make your politics Islamic.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Amen.
Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Research, be someone who's aware, understand what's happening around the world. Understand and look at it through the eyes of insight. If I had more time, we'd talk about Basira, this entire different discussion altogether. How do we understand and look beyond the zahir into the batin? Do we understand why Islamic State is being pounded in the media right now? Everywhere you go, IS, IS, IS. Why? Ask yourself why. Because they realize when the true Islamic State comes in, of the Imam of our time, people will have this affiliation with the word Islamic State to the point when the Imam will come, they'll reject him as well. They've taken our black flags with La ilaha illallah on it and stained it with blood. They've taken the most beautiful sentence in Islam of Allah is the greatest to be a call of violence, where now even you and I sometimes, when we hear Allahu Akbar, we expect a beheading of some time afterwards. It's happening today. But let me make one point here as an ishara and then move towards Masaib. A tree has branches, a tree has roots. You can trim the branches all you want when they come out old and broken and gray. Trim them all you want. They'll grow back. They'll grow back stronger sometimes. You keep trimming, you come back stronger. Keep trimming, come back. After a while, you get tired. When someone says, look, if you want to destroy the tree, leave the branches alone. Uproot the tree from the roots. No. You're lucky I'm not Urdu alima. What is it? Majma kaha hai? The branches are ISIS, the branches are Al-Qaeda, Taliban, one by one, and we hit off the branches. It comes back stronger. To the point where Al-Qaeda says, these ISIS guys, they're too weird for even us. They're too extreme for us. Come back stronger. You wonder what's happening. How come they're not being destroyed? The roots are still inside the tree. Uplift the roots, the branches, khud ba khud, will fall out. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.